Coca-Cola Company, Keurig Dr. Pepper, and PepsiCo are bringing consumers more choices with less sugar than ever before. From sparkling flavored and bottled waters to zero sugar sports drinks, teas, and sodas, consumers are taking advantage of these choices. In fact, nearly 60% of beverages sold contain zero sugar. To learn more, visit balanceus.org.
Study and save this summer with Waubonsie Community College. Earn the same credit as a four-year school at a fraction of the cost. Choose from a variety of popular transferable courses, such as psychology, communications, art, biology, and economics, with many online and hybrid options. So study and save this summer at Waubonsie. Most classes start June 12. Learn more at waubonsie.edu/summer. That's waubonsie.edu/summer.
Back to the Atlanta podcast. I am your host, Mappy Davis, enjoying my afternoon dunks from up the street. Ladies and gentlemen, I have another episode that I got down in Miami from the Super Bowl, but rather than the combination that we got in previous Super Bowl episodes, this one's going to be by himself, Terrence Moore. This is because Terrence Moore is on his own, an ATL podcast. He has been an Atlanta writer for going on 25 years, maybe slightly more than 25 years. He's been on my list of people to get. He has successfully avoided me for this long, but I was finally able to catch up with him. I saw him on my last day. I think he was one of the last interviews I got. And I said, hey, man, you got a few minutes? And he did. So I was able to sit down with him. I think we had a really nice chat. I really like Terrence. You can listen. You can Google him and see all of his accolades, but I know we cover some of them, but essentially he's a guy who's been covering sports for a long time and does Atlanta proud and is not one of these embedded media suck-ups. He tells the truth. He calls people on their nonsense. You can go see his Twitter feed and his articles to check all that out. I'll include that in the show notes. But without any further ado, let's get to my chat with Atlanta legend, I called him, Terrence Moore.
Could I call you Atlanta legend Terrence Moore? Is that acceptable?
If you want to, you call me whatever you want to. People call me, depending on what I write or what I say, people call me all kinds of things.
Well, I want to ask you this. So right before I left, I grew up in Atlanta, then I left.
Oh, okay.
95, 96, the World Series years.
That's
right after that,
ago.
I left. And I missed the entire hip-hop thing. We had that happen, right?
Yes.
And then I came back, I think it's been 12 years now, and is it... I feel like for the longest time, we, Atlanta, like, demanded respect and never got it. But in the last 10 years, something happened.
Well, you know what? I think you've been a little generous. I think the Atlanta that you remember is still the Atlanta that still exists to this day. It's an Atlanta that still, you know, if I haven't been there, it has an inferiority complex.
Right.
And we see it in so many different ways. Like, for instance, since you left, let's start with the biggie, okay? 28-3. Yeah, I mean, that's so Atlanta, right? That's the Atlanta you remember. You remember 1996, Jim Leyritz. You remember that? You remember 1988? Everybody talks about the famous Dominique Wilkins, Larry Bird Game 7.
Right.
That the Hawks lost, by the way.
Right.
That's legendary.
I'm talking about the whole city, though.
Well, this is a city.
But, right. I'll tell you what you just meant. Reminded me, though, I was at the game where Sid Bream came home.
Well, I was there, too. Yeah, that was the loudest I've ever heard. Well, yeah, let me put this way. That was one of the loudest outdoor stadiums I ever heard. And for that particular place, Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, to be that loud in that category was a miracle. And you remember how it was. And the thing was, even before Sid Bream, and people forget about this, the noise started for Atlanta fans in the bottom of the – well, and right as soon as the top of the ninth ended. Top of the ninth ends – Braves are trailing, and the crowd starts going nuts. They were anticipating the comeback.
Well, it was only two runs, so it was like this could actually happen.
Well, but you know, again, Atlanta fans,
right? They
weren't normally like that. That was like something out of the clear blue sky.
But here's what I'm saying about the city in general: that when I came back,
right,
it was still like, hey, we've got Centennial Park and the Coke Museum, right? But in the last 10 years, The movies came. We've got a real food scene. Like, I feel like we finally aren't trying to be New York or Chicago anymore. It's finally like, okay, Atlanta is Atlanta.
Well, along those lines, I agree with you somewhat. Obviously, it's become the film capital of the world. You know about that. You know, where a lot of people like doing shows down there and the Tyler Perry influence. So, yeah, that's been pretty big. But the truth of the matter is, Atlanta's always been kind of like that. You can remember, you talk about the hip-hop scene.
Right.
That's always been there, prevalent. So I'm not really sure that it's changed as much as maybe people think it has. I think it's always been there. Maybe in some respects it's got more notoriety.
So I'm guessing that you started working for all these other places out of necessity, right?
Well, you know,
because like once upon a time, the newspaper industry was it.
That's exactly right.
But it's probably not a horrible thing for you to be all over the place now, though.
Well, let me tell you a quick little story here. When I graduated from Miami of Ohio in May 7th, 1978. A week later, I started working full-time at the Cincinnati Enquirer. I've been doing the same thing ever since, as far as being a professional sports writer, but I've been doing it differently. So when I started working at the Cincinnati Enquirer in 1978, covering Indiana basketball, who was the coach back then?
Oh, Bobby Knight.
That's exactly right. Okay. Bobby Knight. And here's what people forget. Who was the football coach back then?
Was it Woody?
It wasn't Woody.
No. Wait a minute.
It's the guy you see on television quite a bit on ESPN.
At Indiana?
Yes, sir. A lot of people.
Basketball or football?
Football. Yeah, Bobby Knight as a basketball coach. You had this guy, the football coach, Lee Corso, Mr. Master.
Oh, wow.
So I had Bobby Knight and Lee Corso. That's how I started out in this business, covering those guys. And I won't say that. I was going to say something else. But anyway, so I go from Cincinnati to San Francisco in 1980, covering the Oakland Raiders and the San Francisco 49ers. When they first started getting great, the Niners, should say the Raiders always were pretty good. Spent 25 years at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution starting in 1985. Now, I'm saying all that to say, during all that period, I thought I would be at newspapers forever. But it was in May of 2009, I started thinking, people your age don't read newspapers anymore.
Right.
And that's when I just said, I'm out of here. I just really just pulled the plug right then and there. People thought I was crazy in the business.
What year was this?
2009.
Okay.
I decided, I'm out of newspapers. Okay.
You just said, bye to the AJC. I don't want to do anything.
Bye to the AJC. I'm out of here. And I went to AOL Fan House. They were offering me to be a national sports columnist for an internet site. And people were saying, you're going to do this internet thing?
Right.
Okay. Then I started doing more and more television. I've always done television. And then started doing stuff for ESPN and CNN and MSNBC. We came along and that kind of stuff. And that's where I am today. And I was kind of 10 years ago ahead of the curve because I saw exactly what was happening with newspapers.
Right. And so you have your own site still too, yes or no?
I do. I have my own website that I do, T-More Sports. And just the thing that I'm starting that's going to debut Super Bowl Sunday, I'm part of it. Well, not part. I'm basically the guy that's running the website for Sports Illustrated Maven. And we're going to, for the Falcons. I'm doing the Falcons website, Sports Illustrated Maven. That's going to start on Sunday, where it's going to be all things Falcons. Best Falcons coverage you can find is going to be on that SI Maven right there, Sports Illustrated.
So they're going to have, like, embedded writers for every team?
Yeah, every NFL team is going to have its own website. And I'm running the one for the Falcons.
Got it.
We've got a nice staff together, and we're going to kick tail.
Do you want to do this till you're 100?
Yeah, you know, people ask me all the time, when are you going to retire? And my response is always the same. Why? Why would I retire? I mean, What is a better job than being a sports journalist, okay? And it's something that I wanted to do since I was a sophomore in high school. And that was a long time ago.
Right.
So, you know, high school newspaper, worked for my high school newspaper, became the editor of my high school newspaper, go to Miami of Ohio in 1974, oldest college newspaper in the country, joined the newspaper day one, did that for 4 years. I told you my history of newspapers, and I'm doing this right now. There's no reason to do anything else.
Was 28-3? Was that loss the toughest thing you've ever experienced?
If I were a Falcons fan, but being a journalist, you're not really a fan. But you
got to be a little bit.
I'm going to broaden that picture a little bit. One of the things that I tell my students, I'm a journalism professor at Miami, Ohio, and I always tell my students that the best stories, when it comes to like horrific losses, it's not in the winning locker room, it's in the losing locker room. And I'm going to tell you about the three toughest losses I've seen in my life when it came to sports, okay? And it's not 28-3, by the way. I mean, as devastating as that was for Atlanta Falcons fans, I was rather shocked at how, not that they didn't care, but how, you know, I want to say nonchalant. I'm trying to find the right word. It wasn't the overall grief that you think you would have seen in that type of situation. But I'm going to tell you about grief first. The first of the three that I'm going to tell you about was in March of 1981. DePaul, college basketball, was ranked number one. They were a powerhouse, considered invincible. Mark Aguirre, remember Mark Aguirre?
I do.
Okay. This was a team that was, I mean, just, it was just, you, people talk about some of these other teams that came along later with the Duke teams or Vegas. What? This was, at the time, this was it, 1981. So the first game of the NCAA tournament back then, they're playing St. Joseph. Nobody ever heard of St. Joseph. St. Joe, some people heard it now, but back then, nobody heard of it. Dayton Arena, University of Dayton Arena, so you know what's coming. Somehow the game stays close, but everybody's waiting for, you know, DePaul to the spurt. And then at the last second, St. Joe's got the ball, okay, and I remember looking to my right, this guy named, that's New York Times writer, I can't think of his name. Malcolm Moran, that's what it was. I turned to Malcolm Moran, I said, they could lose this game. And so he looked at me with a shocked face. So St. Joe sets up a play, like a backdoor layup, they win the game, game's over. Mark Aguirre, the look on his face, takes the basketball, throws up in the air, and runs out of the arena, okay, on a snowy day in Dayton, Ohio, and Malcolm and I follow him. He goes back to his team hotel, crying his eyes out. And I remember coming back to the DePaul locker room, and it was closed for the longest time, and Ray Meyer was the coach back then. Ray Meyer was about 150 years old at the time. He comes outside the door, and I want to tell you something. That's the first time I thought that I was going to see a coach die on the spot. He was the whitest person I'd ever seen in my life at that point. The blood had just drained from his face, okay? So I thought at that point, there'll be nothing close to that. But there was, okay? And you just talked about it. What did you just talk about when we first started the show?
Talk about Sid Bream?
Sid Bream. Sid Bream game. And for those who may not know, Sid Bream scores the slowest man in the history of Major League Baseball. Scores the winning run, right? Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, okay, against Pittsburgh Pirates. And how he did it. You got Barry Bonds, okay, greatest left fielder of all time. He beats Barry Bonds' throw from left field, okay, wins the game. So Andy Van Slyke was a center fielder back then, and Andy Van Slyke, right before the play, apparently, we find out later, was telling Barry Bonds to move in. And Barry Bonds being Barry
so
Bonds.
So that's why he was sitting like that? That's why he was so devastated?
That's right.
Because I remember that.
Right. I got something else that's even deeper than that. Because what you're referring to is how Andy Van Slyke just sat in the outfield, but it's something deeper than that. So the game is over. And I go to the Braves locker room celebrating, what have you, and that took some time. And I go upstairs, write my story, and that took some time. So I'm leaving old Atlanta Fulton County Stadium, and something just told me, my reporter's instinct just told me, I don't know why, to go to the visiting clubhouse, okay? I mean, this is long after the game. So I go into the visiting clubhouse, and I walk in, and there's nobody there except for one person. Who is it?
I guess it's Andy Van Slyke.
Andy Van Slyke. Sitting at his locker, totally naked, looking straight ahead, like somebody had shot everybody in his family, and it was the end of the world, with his head in his hands just looking down at the floor. That's a scene I'll never forget. But it gets better. Here's the one that might be, if I go 1A, 1B, or 1C, that might be 1C, 1C, 1B. Here's 1A. Or actually, put it in the order you want to put it. Okay, let's go back to 2015.
Okay.
All right. 2015, Arizona Super Bowl. What do you remember about that Super Bowl?
Well, a couple things. One is James Harrison. Is that what you're going to talk about?
No, this is one between the Patriots and the Seattle Seahawks.
Oh, well, the last play of the game, obviously.
That's exactly right.
Right. So you're talking about being in the losing locker room for that one?
In the losing locker room for that. I was literally the first person in the Seattle locker room. And I want to tell you something. Talk about DePaul.
Wait a minute. So you went there because you've had this great experience of being around.
That's exactly right.
So you're just like, everybody's going to talk to the Patriots. I'm going to go talk to Seattle.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Got it.
It's amazing. At the Super Bowl, how many reporters do you have at the Super Bowl?
A lot.
Thousands. Okay. I'm the first one there. And then, you know, about 5-10 minutes, maybe somebody, a couple of Seattle guys kind of straggled in. But again, this is the best kept secret, and I hope the people listening don't tell anybody else because I want to keep this secret. This is always go losing locker room. So I remember when they opened the doors, I have never, ever seen, certainly an NFL team that devastated. Guys sitting at their locker looking at the floor, the cursing, the anger, the despair. I mean, it was all on display.
Are you a little not shy, but hesitant about even talking to a player?
Oh, no question about it. In that situation there, I mean, you don't want to approach anybody. So I didn't. I mean, because you couldn't. Because you got to use some common sense, okay? I mean, this was devastating, okay? And then when a few more riders came in, I mean, there were players. There were only about maybe a couple of players that were willing to talk who could talk. It wasn't because they didn't want to talk. They could not talk, okay? Just looking out in the space. Richard Sherman, oh, my goodness gracious. I mean, I don't think Richard Sherman's left yet. Well, he's at the Super Bowl. But, I mean, they were just looking out in the space. Now, in the midst of all that, there was this one great scene, though. And I've written about this for Forbes.com. I just wrote about this a few months ago. And this is why I respect this guy to this day. I respected him before, but particularly after this. There was one guy who had a smile on his face, not a phony smile, but a smile on his face, and was going around to all of his teammates trying to cheer them up, talking to each one of them individually. Who do you think that person was?
I mean, I'm guessing it's not going to be who I'm thinking.
Russell Wilson.
I was going to say Russell Wilson.
I
thought you were trying to trick me.
No. It was one of the classiest things I've ever seen in my life. Russell Wilson. And you can imagine the grief he was in. He's the one who threw the interception.
Right.
Okay. Going around to each of his teammates. Everything's going to be pat him on the back. You know, cheer up. That kind of stuff. That was amazing. Totally amazing.
All right. I know you got to get out of here. I'm going to ask you one more thing. I am not buying the hype on the United. Everybody 35 and under is, to me, it seems like we got the shiny stadium and this is the shiny kind of hipster in-town thing to do. You've been around sports a long time. You've heard people promise soccer's going to be the next big thing forever. What are your thoughts?
All right, two things. Back when I was an intern at Cincinnati Inquirer in 1977, I had a sports editor named Jim Montgomery. And I'm doing some quick math here. That's 42 years ago, whatever it is. I can't do the math. 45. Anyway, a long time ago, 43 years ago. And Jim Montgomery used to say that the only way that soccer would get into his sports sections would be if they changed the rules and allowed landmines on the field. Okay? And that just tells you how soccer was thought of back then.
Right.
Okay? It's changed since then.
Right.
And, you know, in some circles, not as much. Okay.
Right.
To answer your question, two things here. And this goes back, we're going to bring this conversation full circle, at least where I began it. Atlanta's got an inferiority complex. Okay? It doesn't take very much for the average Atlanta, quote, sports fan, unquote, to get excited. Okay? So once the Atlanta United starts showing a pulse in the second year, people went gaga over the franchise. Oh, my God! You know, that kind of stuff. And, of course, they won the MLS that second year.
Right.
And they actually did pretty good in that first year, too. Okay? And last year, they were one match away from going back to the championship game. And enthusiasm was still there. People were still into it and that sort of thing. This, to me, is going to be the key year. We're going to see whether or not, because there's been a lot of changes, you know. I mean, they still got the two Martinez, and that's a good thing. And Frank DeBoer still has got a lot to prove as whether or not it's going to be another Tata, you know, as far as a head coach of the franchise. This is going to be the key year. If they don't get back to where they were 2 years ago, okay, as far as that championship-type level like that, and if they start slipping a little bit more, if the fans stay with them, then we can truly say that Atlanta has arrived.
Right.
But if this is what Atlanta normally is, a fad town with whatever the hottest thing is, the shiny object.
Right.
And they start going south, the fans will start going south. We'll talk very quickly.
All right. We'll definitely talk in a couple years when we see. Do you feel happy, proud, obligation when it's like, hey, we got a new sports team. I'm an Atlanta guy. I gotta be the guy who's gonna be the beat guy. You know what I mean? Do you feel that way when soccer was coming to town?
Well, not so much so, because like for me, I'm very much old school journalist. And so from a journalist standpoint, you're not allowed to cheer for teams.
No, I know I cheer for, but I'm saying it's gonna be you're gonna be a guy who people count on as a local expert.
Yeah, right. And, but you want from a journalist standpoint, you want to be that.
Right.
And particularly when you see that something is gonna take off. Because you got to present that. In Atlanta, I do a TV show, part of a TV show every Sunday night. We cover all things Atlanta. So certainly, since we're all about all things Atlanta, then we have to really be about what's going on with Atlanta United, certainly the last couple of years, given the mania that's involved.
So, right.
Now I'm going to ask you a question another way, because and not to contradict myself, but you're right. You're onto something. There's no question. People always ask, who do you cheer for? From a sports journalist, we do cheer for teams. You know who we cheer for? What's ever going to be the best story for us? And the best story in Atlanta when it comes to soccer is for the Atlanta United to do well.
Well, so here's a question, though. It used to be what you're saying is true. You weren't allowed to have. But I see Mike Wilbon on TV every day.
Right.
I'm from Chicago. I love the Bears.
Yes.
And he still reports on them.
Right.
But you know.
And again, you bring up another good point. And again.
Why can't you be the Atlanta guy?
Well, I'll put it this way. Okay. And again, this looks like the world's biggest contradiction, so bit.
Okay.
And again, I'm going back to my students. I always tell my students, first day of class. Matter of fact, we had first day of class yesterday. I did it through WebEx here in Miami. The other Miami as opposed to the real Miami of Ohio. But I always tell my students the first day of class, there's no such thing as objective journalism. Because we're all subjective. So your objective is to be the least subjective as possible.
Okay.
Having said that, all of us have backgrounds. I mean, you're an Atlanta guy, right?
Right.
So, I mean, you grew up with the Braves and the Hawks. And who was your favorite team out of that bunch?
I knew the whole Braves lineup. I mean, I remember those summers so well. And then we were good that one year. But, like, Horner and Murphy and Chambliss,
right,
and all those guys.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, for me, I was born and raised in a place called South Bend, Indiana. What team is in South Bend, Indiana?
Well, I mean, Notre Dame.
That's right. The University of Notre Dame, the greatest team in the history of mankind. See what I'm talking about? When you're born and raised in South Bend, you're not a Notre Dame fan.
Right.
It's bigger than that.
Right.
It's in your blood. I mean, yeah, you kind of cut me open right now, heaven forbid, it'll be blue and gold coming out. I mean, Notre Dame, I grew up, the first person I knew outside of my parents was Eric Parsegian.
Okay? Really?
Eric Parsegian is God. And it turns out he went to Miami, Ohio like I did. That's a whole other story. So I realize that I've got this thing for Notre Dame. So when I'm at a Notre Dame game, and I cover at least one Notre Dame game a year, I got to be conscious of that. That I got to put that aside and try to concentrate. And that can lead to some very interesting facial expressions for me because I got to sit there objectively. So, yeah, there is that such a thing where you want to be the least subjective as possible in situations. And then the other thing that happens, like you talk about Atlanta. I've been in Atlanta since 1985. You get attached to not so much to the teams but to the people.
Right.
There's certain people that you really enjoy, that you like. Bobby Cox. Bobby Cox is one of my all-time favorite guys. And Bobby Cox would give me more stuff than he would give your average reporter, maybe more so than any other reporter, because he and I had a really good relationship. And so I'd always had to be conscious of that when I'm writing about Bobby Cox, okay, just to try to be objective, okay. Then there's some other ones I didn't like so much, but I'm not going to give you any names. And I had to be conscious of that too, like, you know, and keep that to the side. So
right.
you always want to try to stay as down the middle as possible.
All right, a couple more Atlanta-based questions, then
sure.
I'll let you go.
Okay.
What is your go-to order at the Waffle House?
You know what? Now, this is going to sound sacrilegious, but I am not a Waffle House guy.
God!
Except for this. My godson is like my son, Julian. Julian is 28 now. When Julian was a little boy growing up there, the only place he wanted to go was the Waffle House. Uncle Terry went to the Waffle House, and my eyes would kind of roll back in the back of my head. So I would go to the Waffle House with Julian, and then I would force myself to eat something for a while, but then I just said, Julian, you're going to go, and Uncle Terry's going to watch you eat.
All right.
Not a Waffle
House. All right. What's your favorite restaurant then in Atlanta today?
OK Cafe.
OK Cafe. Old school.
Have you ever been to OK Cafe?
Of course I have.
OK
it used
Cafe.
To be the only 24-hour restaurant in Atlanta.
It's not 24 hours anymore. It breaks my heart. They went to, now it closes at 10 o'clock. That's unbelievable. But for those who want to go to OK Cafe, it's outstanding.
All right. Kroger or Publix?
Kroger when it comes to salmon. You know, and I want to tell you something. I'm going to sound like I'm shilling for Kroger here. But I want to tell you. Their salmon is awesome, particularly if you put it in the oven bag, like lemon, having put lemon pepper seasoning on it.
Right.
Tremendous, okay? But just for general shopping, I prefer Publix.
Okay.
And one of the things that, you know, I like, what do you call it, those things, apple turnovers.
Right.
I don't know what they do to those apple turnovers, but they're always fresh.
Right.
And awesome. Kroger, not so much.
What is your favorite festival in Atlanta?
Oh, wow. I don't get out much. I don't know.
Other than the sporting events, you mean?
Yeah, I don't know if I have a... Well, you know, this is not a festival. This is not a festival, but it's an event. I really love the King holiday. And
I don't know what that is. Oh, Martin Luther King holiday.
Martin Luther King holiday.
Okay.
And of course, Dr. King is from Atlanta. But the ML King Day ceremony at Ebenezer Baptist Church, that's where Dr. King grew up in, it's fantastic every year. Just the whole presentation, the singing, the people they bring in, all that is worthwhile. So that's what I look forward to interviewing in Atlanta.
All right. When I interview guests in Atlanta, I always end with, who should I have next on the Atlanta podcast? What Atlanta person should I get next?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, if you want to get with somebody that's right here at the Super Bowl, as a matter of fact, is this going to broadcast anytime soon?
I mean, it depends. What would you like to have happen?
Well, I want it to happen, broadcast the next day or so, well, today, because I can promote my column, Forbes.com, which is coming out tomorrow, where I talk to Deion Sanders. Okay, get Deion Sanders if you can get him. Deion Sanders.
I was going to say, you'd have to help me get Deion.
I just interviewed him a few months ago, and Deion was great. Talking about, I'll let you be surprised. You got to look at my column. But I would say get
well, people can still find it, and we can link it.
Yeah, right.
You know, I met Jody Avergan last year. You know who he is?
I do not.
Okay, he does the 30 for 30 podcast.
Oh, okay.
And they did a whole thing on Deion's double play. That.